Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. Here in the UK, we're already 5 days into autumn, and I'll just pause for our North American listeners to shout, no, fall begins on September 21st. But here in Bristol, it's autumn, but it's also a lovely sunny day that's perfect for a barbecue with a few chilled drinks. And a little later in the podcast, we'll talk about how physics can tell you how to cook the perfect steak, and also how long that bottle of rosé will take to chill in the freezer. We'll also hear from my colleague Margaret Harris about how atomic physicists studying anti-hydrogen could help us peer beyond the standard model of particle physics. But first, I'm joined by Mateen Durrani to talk about what's hot in the world of physics and also how to pick the perfect name for your physics spin-out company. Hi, Mateen. So is it still summer to you?
Well, we were just talking about that, Hamish. I still think it's summer. You know, to me, look, first of all, my kids went back to school, so it's still summer. And it's also the cricket season still on, so that counts as still summer. It's still a warmth in the air. So I say it's autumn starts 21st September.
So you're with the North Americans?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I have to say I do agree. It seems a bit early. I mean, especially today, as I was just out at lunch, and it was lovely out there, and I could imagine myself barbecuing with a nice chilled bottle of rosé at my side. So
we'll come around to your house for the weekend then.
We'll have to scrape the rust off the barbecue first.
So it's still officially summer.
It is.
All right. But anyway, yeah, back to the physics. So we were chatting about this story. You've written a story about quantum Darwinism. And I'm afraid I haven't read the story, and I don't know if all our listeners have read it either. So you better tell us what exactly is quantum Darwinism.
Ooh, well, I was afraid you were going to ask me that question, Mateen. And I should point out that it wasn't me who wrote the article. It was a regular contributor, Edwin Cartledge, who struggled with quantum Darwinism. What quantum Darwinism is, at least as far as I can tell, is a way of understanding how a system makes the transition from the murky, probabilistic world of quantum mechanics to the clear-cut and definite realm of classical physics.
All right, so I'm still not clear. What's the link with Darwin? Is it about sort of the survival of the fittest, or what is it?
Yeah, it's sort of the survival of the fittest quantum state. So if you think of a quantum state, such as the spin of an electron, and think of it as starting off as being isolated from its environment. And so we know from quantum mechanics that it exists in a superposition of spin up and spin down quantum states. It's never in a definite state, but rather it exists as a coherent wave-like oscillation of up and down states. But things start to get strange when we try to measure the spin of the electron. And we can't actually detect this superposition. Instead, we find that the electron spin is either up or either down. We measure a clear-cut classical result. And that's sort of where the Darwinism comes in.
Oof, you're stretching the limit of my understanding. So how did the spin kind of go from, I mean, you're saying from a quantum superposition to the definite result. How did that happen?
Well, that's where this concept of quantum Darwinism comes in. For the measurement of the spin to be made, the spin must interact with the measuring apparatus. And this involves multiple interactions in which the spin becomes quantum mechanically entangled with a large number of particles in the measuring device. Now, these interactions tend to destroy quantum states. But the idea, the sort of Darwinian idea, is that some states are more robust than others, and they will survive for a bit longer. And then the idea is taken a bit further, such that the survivor state will somehow be able to replicate itself many times over and dominate the interaction with the measurement device. And then ultimately, this state will emerge as the measured value. So the process is essentially the survival of the fittest quantum state.
So, I mean, Hamish, what sort of systems were they measuring? And, you know, how did they do the measurements? What techniques did they use?
Well, this was done by physicists in Germany and the US, and they used isolated spins in diamond as their quantum state. Now, these spins were allowed to interact with the spins of a handful of carbon-13 nuclei that are nearby in the diamond lattice. These carbon spins approximated the measuring device. And by studying how the interactions progressed, the team was able to confirm some aspects of quantum Darwinism. And you can read more about this in Quantum Darwinism Spotted in Diamond Spins, which was written by Edwin Cartledge.
It's funny, Hamish, we always say whenever there's a quantum story, you just put anything attached to quantum and it always gets loads of reads on the website. We were talking this morning about not quantum Darwinism, but quantum money.
Quantum money, that's right, yeah.
That you were going to look into for later in the month.
Yeah.
So people just love all that quantum stuff. It's certainly on our website, it's always one of the most popular areas, because I think it's that kind of mystique about it, the mystery that kind of no one really understands. And there's so much exciting work going on that it always makes it very popular.
Yeah, I mean, this was a really interesting experiment. And a great article by Edwin. But I have a funny feeling that maybe the headline helped, because, of course, in the headline, we've got quantum, we've got Darwinism, and we've got diamond, all in a very short headline. So, that story has been very, very popular with readers.
All right, so that was quantum Darwinism. So what else is big this week in physics?
Well, on the medical physics front, we have a story with the headline, "Smartphone-based device detects norovirus." And I think norovirus is that nasty sort of gastrointestinal disease that people tend to get in the winter, isn't it?
Definitely one to avoid.
That's right. Yeah. Anybody with small children knows that that's something that should be avoided, but probably very difficult.
So how then you can detect it with a smartphone?
Yeah, that's right. Some researchers have come up with, or they've built, an inexpensive smartphone-based fluorescence microscope that can detect tiny amounts of norovirus in water. And then on the renewable energy front, we have a story with the headline, "California Sunsets Bring Solar Woes." And this is about how electricity companies in the Golden State are dealing with differences in when solar power is generated during the day and the peak times for electricity demand, which is in the evening. So, some interesting challenges there in making the transition towards renewable energy. And finally, in our coverage of diversity and inclusion in the physics community, we have a story headlined, "Gender Gap in Science Exam Performance Disappears for Longer Tests." And this describes research that shows that while boys perform better than girls at the beginning of a test, the gap closes the longer the exam goes on.
So what girls do better as the exam, literally as the exam progresses, their performance improves compared to the boys?
I think so, yeah.
So as usual, Hamish, an eclectic mix of news on the Physics World website, but I definitely want one of those norovirus smartphones. I think they could be big business.
I don't know. Do you really want to know what sort of nasty bugs are out there? You might never come out of your house again.
Well, there is that, but I definitely think there's a market for that.
So next up, we're going to chat about how to come up with a fantastic name for your physics spin-out company. Mateen's still here with me. And Mateen, we had a really funny article on the website by our regular columnist, James McKenzie, about naming companies. What are some of James's top tips for coming up with a name?
Well, for people who don't know James, James McKenzie is the vice president for business at the Institute of Physics. And he's also got a long track record in running and managing companies. And for the past couple of years, he's had a column in Physics World called Transactions, where he talks about issues facing physicists working in business. And some are a bit more serious. This one was a bit more lighthearted, and it was all about the challenge of naming your company. Because he was involved in a venture recently with some people, and they were sort of one of the trickiest things, or one tricky thing, was deciding what to name the company. And in the article, he talks about some of the pitfalls of getting the name wrong.
I mean, I think one thing that comes to mind immediately, because I know physicists have a problem, you know, sort of thinking creatively around ideas. And one is just being too literal. Your company does this, and so therefore your name must reflect exactly what the company does, and it has to be accurate from a scientific point of view, etc. I think that's a real problem for physicists, getting out of that mindset.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, it is sort of, you would think that the default option is to name the company after the thing you're making. But the danger is, of course, you could change your product line in a couple of years, and then you're stuck with this company that's no good anymore. But I mean, there are some pretty well-known companies that are pretty run seals. So you've got Oxford Instruments, Zurich Instruments. I mean, I was looking through the latest issue of Physics World, where there's some, you know, prominent advertisers, and you know, there are quite a few companies with just the name of the technology in it. So that's the sort of, you know, a sort of safe way, as long as you can assume that your product range stays pretty much consistent. But as I said, something like Oxford Instruments, that's really clever because it has the cachet of Oxford, but also the instruments, but it could be anything.
That's right. I mean, the company's been around for a long time, and they've made lots of different things. And, you know, Oxford Instruments fits in with just about everything that they make. So, you know, am I wrong in thinking that they started off making magnets? Is that right?
I think that's right. But, you know, they do all sorts of microscopes and nanoprobes and all sorts of stuff like that.
But if they'd called it Oxford Magnets, then, you know, they would have been stuck, wouldn't they?
Well, exactly.
Whereas so. Oxford Instruments is, you know, it's the perfect name for them.
So in the article, James McKenzie makes a couple of really good points. So when he says there are three things to think about when you're naming a company, the first one, it mustn't be trademarked, so someone else doesn't have that idea. Secondly, it has to be available as a name, so it's worth doing a search at company's house or the equivalent in whichever country you're in. And also you have to check that the URL is available, because obviously online sales and retail and presence is hugely important these days. And then, of course, the other thing is you have to make sure that your name in another language doesn't translate as something really dodgy. And that can be really quite tricky. And, of course, the funny example he uses of Toyota, which had a sports car called MR2, which sounds sort of safe enough, but if you pronounce it in French, I think it means shit. Am I allowed to use that word on the podcast? Yeah, so, you know, they had to be very careful. And I think they renamed it in France, what that the car is called, or it didn't sell very well over there. So, yeah, checking the translation of the country, got to be really, really careful.
Yeah, that's there's a funny story about a Canadian company called Mitel as well. What was that all about? Something about telephones and versus lawnmowers.
Well, I'd never heard of this before, but it's a company. It was set up by two people, Michael Copeland and Terry Matthews, in 1973. And they were working for a Canadian telecoms firm, and they wanted to set up their own company in that field. But they told their employer that they were they just wanted to sell lawnmowers. So they called themselves Mike and Terry Lawnmowers, which was Mitel. So they got the blessing to do that, thinking it was lawnmowers. But of course, what they actually wanted to do was to sell this computing stuff, which is what they went on to do, and they're still around. So they kind of, under the guise of selling lawnmowers, they actually got that name through the radar, and we used that sort of technology that had been inspired by their time in the company. But yeah, you know, obviously, ego can take over, and a lot of founders of physics-based businesses decide to name the company after themselves. And I mean, there are loads of successful companies where the name of the person is in the title, you know, Edison Electric, Marks and Spencer's, Ford Car Company, McDonald's. So, you know, it can be successful. But the example James uses was, I don't know if it's true or not, but there was a guy called Stuart Hall who set up an international travel company. So his company was called Stuart Hall International Travel. So those initials didn't spell something particularly good. So you've got to be really careful if you let ego take over and, you know, name the company after yourself.
I mean, I suppose the thing that's trendy these days are sort of phonetic spellings or taking random letters out of a word. I mean, that seems, I think that that would become very dated in the future. But then again, you know, there's Kinetic, you know, which that's a spin out in the UK. And I think that is that 10, 15 years old or something like that? It's been a while since Kinetic.
Yeah, so that they were set up as the spin off from the old Defence Evaluation and Research Agency. So that was a government agency that did research into defence and military matters. And they spun off that company and called it Kinetic, Q-I-N-E-T-I-Q. And I remember at the time thinking, what a ridiculous name. Two Qs in it, and the end Q is a capital as well. But you know, that company's still going strong, and I actually really like it. But I think sometimes you can be, physicists can be a bit too clever. And I told you before, Hamish, every Wednesday, you know, I play five-a-side football with other people at IOP, and there's a guy there who works at the University of Bristol, who works for a company called KETS, K-E-T-S, and that's a sort of anyone
Dirac
who knows,
notation, isn't it?
That's the quantum mechanics. Yeah, you got the Bra and the Ket, so quantum spin state, the thing we were talking about before, that the Bra is the one state with the sort of square bracket pointing left and the line is the Bra, and the other state is the Ket. So they called it Ket technology, which I said to him, whenever I see him playing football, I think that's a ridiculous name for a company. However, here we are talking about it, so maybe it's not so dumb after all, because, you know, sometimes names that are a bit weird can be memorable.
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, my favorite is D-Wave, the Canadian quantum computer maker. And, you know, of course, D-Wave refers to a type of superconductivity, and they make their quantum computers using superconducting circuits. So, you know, I think that that's a fantastic name, D-Wave, because it's very memorable, but you also get it. Although I have to say, I was very nerdy earlier on today. I was on the internet trying to work out whether the superconductor that they use in their circuits is actually a D-Wave superconductor, because of course there are other kinds of superconductors.
And is it?
I'm not quite sure, actually. It's niobium. I think it might possibly be, but. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, that you can see that's sort of the problem you get into. You think, oh, I've got a great name. It's D-Wave. But then somebody says, I think you'll find your superconductor is an S-Wave. Well, you know, do you really want to get into those details? I'm not sure.
The other really interesting example in the article was, obviously, everyone knows Google, that originally was called Google because that's 10 to the power 100, and that was indicating how much information they were trying to mine, and then they got misspelled Google. However, I didn't realize that initially what they wanted to call it was, they wanted to call the search technology Backrub, which sounds ridiculous. And for 2 years, from 95 or 6 to 97, they called it Backrub because apparently, I looked this up just before we started the podcast, that it was to indicate the number of backlinks a web page had to other pages. Because I think Google's original algorithm was based on how many links one page had to another. I think it's changed now.
Oh, for ranking.
Yeah, but it used to be the number of backlinks to other pages, so they called it Backrub, which frankly sounds ridiculous nowadays. And of course, Google's a very clever name, an all-powerful search engine that we all use for better or worse. But yeah, Backrub sounds, you know, they're probably relieved they didn't go with that in the end.
And finally, here's a name that I like, but is maybe a bit vague. Now, Mateen, you're familiar with Chalk River Nuclear Labs. I think your dad used to work there.
He did, and I was born somewhere near there, yeah, that's right.
Now, there's a company, a spin-out company from Chalk River. It's actually based in the village of Chalk River on Highway 17. And it's called Bubble Technology Industries.
Oh, yeah.
Now, any guesses for what Bubble Technology Industries makes?
Well, I'm guessing cloud chambers, something like that.
You're getting there, yeah. They make personal radiation detectors.
Ah, okay.
And I think these radiation detectors work because tiny bubbles are produced in the material. And then you take the detector away and you count the number of bubbles. And that tells you your dosage.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
And there was one, but before we finish, one last company in the article that James mentioned was LG, the Korean electronics firm. And they used to be called Lucky Gold Star. And then they changed it to LG with a sort of subtitle, Life's Good, which is pretty clever. I'm not sure about Lucky Gold Star. Apparently, they used to sell sort of bargain basement TVs. So they've kind of, by changing LG, they've kind of gone seemingly rebranded themselves and gone a little bit upmarket. Anyway.
So that article by James McKenzie is called Google, Mitel, or LG, The Fine Art of Naming Your Business. And you can find that on the Physics World website. And Mateen, you've also done a poll of our readers, haven't you, to see how they would name their companies.
Yeah, that's right. So I've got the results here. So 56% of people said they would go with a kind of quirky name. 15% only said they would name it after themselves. So there's not many big EOs in physics. 13% said they would use some kind of technical term, which is what we were talking about at the start, you know, actually being very deliberately naming it after the thing that you're making. And 14% said go for something bland. So quirky and unique seems to be the prevailing view. Of course, these people, most of them probably haven't set up their own company, so they're not, well, nor have I, so what do I know what I'm talking about? But those are the results from Twitter.
Well, that's great, Mateen. Thanks. Now I'm joined by my colleague, Margaret Harris. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Hamish.
And this week, earlier this week, you were at an atomic physics conference in Birmingham, but you were talking about CERN. Those are two things that don't normally go together, atomic physics and CERN.
Well, yeah, so I was at the QAMP conference, which is Quantum Atomic Molecular Physics, and this is actually the third QAMP I've been at. The first one in 2007, I was a PhD student in Quantum Atomic and Molecular Physics. The second one, I was a science journalist reporting for Physics World from the conference. And this year, I actually went to the conference officially in my capacity as a member of the IOP's Business Innovation and Growth Group, which is the IOP's group for sort of promoting small businesses and industrial physicists. And it was, you know, you say it's ironic that I was at an atomic physics group talking about CERN, but it was really ironic that to be at an atomic physics conference talking about industry stuff, because the first, when I first attended this QAMP conference back in 2007, that was just nowhere on the radar. And yet, even in the one day of talks I attended, we had one person talking about how he was thinking about founding a startup to commercialize technologies that are coming out of his lab laboratory. So,
Is this mostly quantum information? I mean, that's the first thing that strikes my mind when you talk about atomic physics. You know, you can use atoms as qubits, that sort of thing. Is that?
It's partly that, but it's much more. The near-term stuff seems to be in things like quantum magnetometers and quantum gravimeters or gravity meters. So that was the type of things that was being discussed at the talks I saw. So anyway, back to we'd sort of trailed this idea about CERN here. The experiment that I saw some posters on was the alpha experiment at CERN.
Now that's a very exotic atom, isn't it? What sort of atoms are they looking at there?
They're looking at anti-hydrogen atoms. And regular readers of Physics World will maybe remember the alpha experiment. We've covered a number of times in the website. And the alpha experiment, along with another CERN group that also studies anti-hydrogen, won Physics World's Breakthrough of the Year award in 2010 for trapping anti-hydrogen atoms. So this is where the worlds of particle physics and atomic physics collide, really, because if you want to study particles that are whizzing around at really high speeds and running into each other, you talk to a particle physicist. But if you want to get those particles to move really, really slowly and not interact with anything at all, because, of course, in the case of anti-hydrogen, if they interact with things, they annihilate and you've got no anti-hydrogen anymore. If you want that sort of experiment done, you talk to an atomic physicist because they're very experienced at trapping atoms and keeping them away from the rest of the world so we can study them.
Now, antihydrogen, that's an antiproton and a positron, which is an antielectron. So that is a piece of antimatter that can be made in the lab and captured in the lab and studied in detail.
Yeah, so the way it works is the CERN antiproton decelerator provides about 30 million antiprotons at 5 megaelectron volts, MeV, every 2 minutes. And about 100,000 of these are captured, cooled, and brought to interact with a cloud of cold positrons that come from a radioactive source. And then from this interaction, you do form neutral antihydrogen atoms. And this interaction takes place in the alpha experiment, and it takes place in a trap that's about half a Kelvin deep, so not 0.5 Kelvin deep. So anything with a higher energy just leaves, so you lose it.
So you've got ultra-cold antihydrogen there.
You've got cold antihydrogen. In the atomic physics community, ultra-cold is saved for things like sort of millikelvin and microkelvin.
Okay.
So you've got cold antihydrogen. So you can do a number of things with once you have anti-hydrogen, but the most interesting things you can do is really to study the differences, if there are any, between the way that anti-hydrogen behaves versus the way that hydrogen behaves.
Because that could tell you something, because the standard model of particle physics says that they should behave the same?
Yes, and in a number of important ways they should behave the same. So they should have the same transition frequencies of their electrons moving between energy levels, and they should behave the same under gravity. Antimatter should not fall up, according to the standard model of physics, and it shouldn't even behave differently from normal matter under the force of gravity. There's a lot of difficulties in getting just making it in the first place is difficult. But they're now starting to investigate some of the properties of antihydrogen in more detail. So one of the people I spoke to was a physicist called April Cridland, and she had a poster called "Towards a CPT Investigation with Direct Comparisons of Hydrogen and Antihydrogen." Now CPT refers to charge parity time reversal symmetry. And if that symmetry is violated, then it's a violation of the standard model. It suggests there's physics beyond the standard model. So April and her colleagues are trying to pin down what we know about energy levels in an anti-hydrogen atom, which is specifically the transition frequency of an anti-electron moving between the 1s and 2s levels within anti-hydrogen. So the value of this number, this frequency, is known in regular hydrogen to within 4 in 10 to the minus 15. And if it's any different than anti-hydrogen, then that would violate this charge parity time reversal symmetry. So far, their current sensitivity isn't as good as it is in hydrogen. It's down at around about 2 times 10 to the 12th. But they're now looking at sort of improving their detectors in order to detect the light that comes out when an anti-electron makes this transition. The wavelength of that light, April was telling me, is approximately 121 nanometers, which is actually really quite difficult to detect. And they're particularly working on getting a detector that's capable of recording that light under cryogenic conditions and at the sensitivity they need.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, normally we think of, you know, searches for physics beyond the standard model. We think of huge colliders and huge energies and you know, looking for evidence there. But this is almost completely different, isn't it? You don't have things smashing or tons of energy. It's very, very precise, very, very, it's a very different environment, isn't it? But it still could. That could be the place where we see, we do get a breakthrough in our understanding of the universe. And that's not all people are doing with anti-hydrogen, is it? They're looking for other things.
I think that you're mentioning about it being a very different type of experiment. It's really kind of a hybrid experiment, because, of course, you have the accelerator on the front end, and then you have bolted onto it. I mean, I've not actually been to the alpha experiment, so I don't know exactly what it looks like, but it seems conceptually that you've got bolted onto this big particle physics thing, you've got this relatively small atomic physics thing going on together. So it's a neat interplay between these two fields that, you know, maybe in most areas you'd think of them being quite different. But yeah, you mentioned they have other things going on. So I mentioned earlier that's one of the tests they're trying to do on antihydrogen is to figure out how it behaves under gravity. So last year, in 2018, the ALPHA experiment expanded its anti-hydrogen setup to include a vertical atom trap. And this is for testing how anti-hydrogen behaves under gravity. What they're trying to measure here is the ratio of the gravitational mass to the inertial mass. For hydrogen, that ratio, I think, is basically 1 to very good precision. They're the same. So far, the alpha experiment has only pinned down the anti-hydrogen ratio to within some pretty big error bars. The true number could be anywhere from minus 65 to positive 110.
So a bit more work to do then.
A bit more work to do, because that range basically means that antimatter could fall up, or it could fall down, but at a different rate to matter. And so far, they've been doing these measurements by sending out a beam of anti-hydrogen and detecting where it ends up as it's allowed to sort of fall in free space. But another poster presenter, Joanna Pesca, was telling me that it's difficult to improve the sensitivity of that measurement. And she's working on an alternative approach, which is that instead of letting the hydrogen fall in free space, they're developing a way of exactly canceling out the gravitational force with a magnetic field by cooling the anti-hydrogen even further in a magnetic trap and observing its behavior. And Peshka said that this will give them better sensitivity, but in order to get that sensitivity, they need to know the magnetic fields really, really well. Because otherwise, the uncertainty in their knowledge of the magnetic field will dominate the gravity measurements, and that's what they're working on.
Well, that's really interesting, Margaret. Thanks for explaining that to us. So I'm joined again by Mateen, and as promised, we're going to talk about barbecues and chilling drinks. So what's your favorite tipple, Mateen? I'm guessing a 500ml bottle of German beer?
Well, you know me, Hamish, I haven't been drinking for a while, so I'll go for a lime and soda. How about that?
Okay, as long as it's 500ml, let's say you forgot to chill your lime and soda
right
before your garden party.
Okay.
How long do you need to leave it in the freezer to get it at an optimal 6 degrees Celsius? What do you think?
So hang on. So it started at room temperature and you want to put it in the freezer to get it down to 6 degrees.
That's right. Yep.
So you want me to guess or are you about to tell me? I reckon...
I'll have a guess.
It's probably something complicated to do with Newton's law of cooling. So let me see. So it starts at 20 degrees, takes it down to 6. 2 hours?
I'd be frozen solid by then.
Really?
The answer, according to the online chilled drinks calculator, is 1 hour and 2 minutes.
Ooh.
And that calculator was created by two physicists in Warsaw.
So what is it? Is that a theoretical study or have they done a load of experiments to work out the numbers?
I believe that it's calculation-based. And there are other cooling options available. For example, you could pop your drink in the fridge. It would take considerably longer. You could put it in an ice bath, or you could even leave it outside on a cold night. All of these options are available on the calculator, and it will tell you how cold your drink will be after a certain period of time.
Well, I was at by one. What did I say? 2 hours, and it was 1 hour. Well, in physics, that's the right order of magnitude. So I'll say I'm approximately right there. But what about the barbecue? What does that? What does the calculator tell us about how long you've got to cook stuff?
Well,
the perfect steak.
I'm afraid the calculator doesn't tell you anything about cooking. You're going to have to work that out by reading a separate paper, which is called A Mathematical Model for Meat Cooking by Hala Shahade of the University of Florida and colleagues. But be warned, they have modeled your expensive cut of beef as a poroelastic medium saturated with fluid.
Sounds delightful.
So you might want to take their advice with a dash of salt and pepper.
That was a terrible joke, Hamish. But, you know, you're good at those. So where can I read more about these articles?
Well, you can find links to the calculator and the meat paper in my blog post, Chilled Drinks Calculator, The Mathematics of a Cooking a Steak and Physics-Related Screensavers. And by the way, those screensavers are courtesy of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. Now, is that a thumbs up or a thumbs down for their name?
Rubbish.
You can't picture these physicists on the perimeter of reality doing their calculations?
To me, it just sounded like a fence. It was like fencing off the rest of the world from their institute.
So
I was never a big fan of that place, which both you and I have been to in Canada.
So you're not a fan of the place or the name?
The name. The place is brilliant.
Place is brilliant.
Top Theory Institute, but the name.
It's funny that, you know, I never thought of it as, you know, sort of elitist name. I always thought...
Just made that up since you asked me.
Well, it's a good point, it's a bit too late because the Perimeter's been around for about, 20 years now, and I don't think they'll be changing their name anytime soon. Well, that's all we have for this week's podcast. Many thanks to Margaret and Mateen for joining me today, and to Callum Jelf for doing the behind-the-scenes magic required to bring the Physics World Weekly podcast to your ears. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe via Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast app. And you can also follow us on Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Physics World.